Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast, sponsored by BetBull. My name is Jake Entwistle, if you didn't already know, and on this week's episode, we're going to be discussing some more evergreen topics given the current situation. Firstly, we're going to be looking at what is actually happened. There is no football being played. What does that mean? When will we see some football again? And what can we look forward to, if anything? And then also touching on some transfer debate, Bruno Fernandes, positions with Paul Pogba, all of that to come. But first, let me introduce the guests that will be joining me. First is Chief Editor at Squawker, Will Hall. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Are you keeping well?
I'm keeping well enough.
We're all here, so that's one good sign. Chief Writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt, welcome back.
Welcome. Last time for a while, maybe. Well, who knows?
Yeah, we don't know. Capped up today.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't have time to.
Casual.
He's having a bad hair day.
Yeah, pretty much. So now I'm having a hat day instead.
Perfect. And the final guest, as I said, chief voice for hire at the moment, Ollie Young-Miles. Welcome back.
Hello.
A repeat of last week's recording. And as Mo alluded to there, it's first up, we'll just say that this is the last recording we're going to be doing from our safe space, our soundproof room of podcast production. We may have some things coming in the later months. They may be of reduced sound quality. They may be different voices. We are looking into what we can do, but at the moment we cannot promise when they will appear or what they will be about. So this is a podcast that will last you the coming months. You can dip back into it whenever you want. As we said, the first part is going to be updating the situation on how the coronavirus is impacting the world of football. And in that regard, we're recording on a Monday, and it's just before UEFA is set to have a big meeting about whether seasons will be suspended. Euro 2020 is going to be moved to Euro 2021. How the seasons will be finished, if they are finished. So with all of the preamble out of the way about what to expect and when to expect our voices once again, I'm going to ask Will to tell us what UEFA might be discussing at this potential meeting and what information they potentially have when making their huge decision.
Well, I mean, in the broadest possible strokes right now, the decision is between resuming the season and completely abandoning it. In public, all the major heads of the divisions concerned with the outcome of tomorrow's convention between the UEFA member associations and the relevant club representatives, we're pretty much seeing across the board public commitments to resuming the season, however possible. The problem is the question that comes after, or if they do decide to resume the season, is when do you resume it? Forecasting a return date is like building a strategy on a foundation of sand right now, given the unprecedented nature of this particular outbreak. Last week, the message from UK's chief medical officer was that the coronavirus outbreak will be in its peak between 10 and 14 weeks from now. The Guardian reported on Sunday evening that privately, NHS authorities have been warned that the virus could still be circulating till next spring, 2021. Assuming major UK sporting events won't resume till sometime after the virus outbreak is expected to hit that peak in 10 to 14 weeks from now, footballers may have to maintain their own personal fitness plans alone for over 3 months. Former Liverpool physio Mark Leather, speaking to Sky Sports, I think either today or just yesterday, he's suggesting that players are going to be less motivated, training in isolation. We've already seen Mason Mount disobeying Chelsea club orders to self-isolate by meeting up with Declan Rice for a kickabout.
Naughty boy. Trying to rehash their Chelsea academy days.
Which I think highlights just it's a completely different level of self-discipline, this being told to self-isolate and stay in your own quarters for what could be weeks, if they're following the advice based on when the symptoms should have died down or showed themselves.
And on the flip side of that, we saw Sergio Ramos pounding away on his treadmill for at a ridiculous speed.
Exactly, and most
in his own flat or well house.
Top level athletes are going to be paid well enough to be able to afford these kind of setups, home gyms and stuff like that. But without having your teammates around you, the motivation levels aren't going to be quite there.
Yes, yeah, there are certain players who will thrive, and some players will just be like, well, yeah. Understandably so, yeah. I would imagine.
And then coaching becomes much harder if your players aren't allowed to gather in the same space. No matter how effectively you work around those two things, match fitness isn't going to be there if there are no matches to play. So it's doubtful whether the Premier League or if any of these leagues resume when possible, when the relevant stakeholders deem it safe enough for these competitions to resume, whether the quality of product is going to be quite the same given this downtime. As you've alluded to, Euro 2020, I think there's a general consensus among reporters that we'll expect that to be pushed back to the following summer, based on tomorrow's meeting. I did see reported one possible solution to UEFA club competitions, the Europa League and the Champions League, is to try and sacrifice as many games as possible while preserving the sporting integrity of the competition, vis-a-vis holding the semi-finals over a couple days and making the semi-finals one-legged affairs, so that you can scratch two games off that competition.
Be like the Emirates Cup.
But like I said, with given the unprecedented nature of this virus and how it unfolds, it's very difficult to say with any confidence when these players will be able to get back to work.
That fits in with what Brighton's chief executive Paul Barber has said in saying that it's really hard to imagine a Premier League game taking place on its scheduled turn of the 4th of April, which is less than a month away. And if the predictions you've said there or mentioned from reports about the virus reaching its peak in 10 to 14 weeks, that seems like an overly ambitious plan. And I think most leagues were scheduled or suspended indefinitely, weren't they, until the beginning of April, which now looks like that's going to be something completely different.
I think another thing that's collectively agreed upon with regards to that date is that it's not really a date for which we can expect the Premier League to return. It's more of a date that was put out there to allow the Premier League to meet up, receive the outcome of the UEFA convention taking place tomorrow, and just give them breathing space in which to make an assessment on all the complex issues that go along with deciding how you complete the season, or if you abandon it entirely. Wayne Rooney is one of the maybe highest profile players who's given the player's point of view from this perspective. He suggested capitalising on the fact that the next World Cup is going to be a Winter World Cup in 2022. And in his words, you could actually use this as an opportunity to say we're going to finish the 2019-20 season later this year, then prepare for 2022 by having the next two seasons starting in winter. So it could completely revolutionise the football fixture calendar before the whole situation is over.
Wayne Rooney galaxy braining everyone.
I mean, he went to America, didn't he? Although not to the LA Galaxy, I suppose. But you know, he's went over there with a balding man reputation. People like him.
He had his hair transplant before he went.
No, but he's come back with a prop. They must have some very good clinics over in America. He's come back with a thick beard and a thick head of hair. He looks. And he's come back with the thick takes as well, man. Well, thick in different way than we.
Yeah, you're thick
in a good way. Thick without the K.
Yes, thick without the K takes.
I think another thing it strikes on is how incorrect the presumption that next season's schedule won't be impacted by this epidemic.
It can't not be. Like you think about how much work goes into just pre-season, and pre-season starts mid-July, and they're still thinking this is probably going to still be going on.
That presumption seems to be at the heart of the other side of the coin in this one, which is those proponents of abandoning the season entirely. The Premier League and all the major domestic divisions across Europe are committed, or saying they're committed, to completing this season.
They kind of have to, don't they?
But Greg Clark, the FA chairman, reportedly expressed fears that won't be possible during the meeting that the EFL and the Premier League had last Thursday. But unlike with adopting the policy of completing the season, the more positive policy, the question then becomes, okay, then what? do you declare it null and void as Karen Brady suggested before appearing to backtrack on Twitter? She's not alone in both of those respects. Lyon president Jean-Michel Aulas said the course of action, that particular course of action, would be the most logical thing, and then he also then backtracked.
Well, again, he, like Karen Brady, has been accused of acting in self-interest by, I think, Dmitry Payet, no less. Sort of laughed down his comments based on how poor a season Lyon have had. It's been one of Lyon's most troublesome seasons in recent years, with Silvinho really struggling at the start of the season, and you know, they've struggled to replace the players they sold last summer and have been languishing in mid-table for much of the season. So a loss of Champions League revenue for them would obviously hit them hard. And
of course, he'll be one of the most concerned parties with the outcome of tomorrow's meeting with regards to what UEFA does, particularly with the Champions League competition. They're still, still
alive. They've got a 1-0 lead over Juventus.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. As much as it is easy to dismiss, because the people piping up about it are ones that have an interest in seeing the season abandoned, it is arguably the most logical thing to do, because you're not going to renew the season in its unless you do the Rooney plan, follow the Rooney plan. You're not really going to have to find enough room to fit the rest of the season's fixtures into whatever time you want before you start next season.
Yeah, so, certainly not without making significant compromises.
Exactly, and then what is the point? Then with the exception of the Premier League, which Liverpool are basically going to win. Everyone sort of accepted that. Everything else is still up for grabs. It's still well in play. La Liga's got a very hotly contested title race. Bundesliga 2.
Serie A
is hotter than it's ever been. You know, and then Liga as well. Maybe you could argue, but that's just the top five leagues. Lots of leagues have proper title races going on right now, so you can, and then not to mention relegation and promotion, so you could see,
and the cups
the cups are all still in flow, so you can see why, how would you fairly bring that all back into play.
The problem is it's a legal minefield, isn't it, if they do cancel the season, because I mean, a lot of clubs, as we mentioned, the difference between a couple of places in the Premier League table in terms of prize money and things like that and qualifying for the Champions League or avoiding relegation is massive.
Yeah, that's to declare the season null and void was just going to invite legal challenges. In particular, you would say from the likes of Leeds and West Brom, who are in those two automatic promotion spots. Last season, the Premier League participation earned Huddersfield, who finished last, £97 million, and the eventual champions Manchester City, £151 million. Across TV revenue and all sorts of things. Denying Leeds and West Brom the opportunity to that is going to potentially, as everyone is saying, result in legal challenges. With respect to those two teams, though, going back to Paul Barber, the Brighton executive who we referenced earlier, he suggested, and I think this is reportedly being considered in Germany as well, he suggested expanding the competition to 22 teams for next season. So you're giving Leeds and West Brom those two extra spots. Then you expand the number of teams who are relegated from next season to 4, while scrapping next season's championship playoffs to decrease the number of teams promoted from that to 2 teams rather than 3. And in so doing, you restore the Premier League to a 20-team competition for the 2022 seasons, 2023 season.
The issue with that is, I think in the Premier League, we can all agree on that Liverpool are deserved champions because they are 25 points clear. But in the Championship, if Leeds and West Brom had a similar advantage in terms of points from them to third place team, then I think you could also make that sort of argument. But Fulham in third are only 6 points behind West Brom in second and only 7 points behind Leeds in top with 9 games to play. And I think this is another thing that will just invite legal challenges from teams like Fulham, Brentford and Nottingham Forest as well. Fourth and fifth are on 60 points, so 10 points and 11 points respectively
very
behind.
Tight.
And the Championship is renowned for being, you know, one of the most unpredictable leagues in the world, really. And these teams will not... I can't see them accepting that Leeds and West Brom, albeit are probably the two best teams in the division, deserve to go straight up.
But I misspoke a moment ago. Yeah, it would actually be the 21-22 season that is restored to 20 teams. I think no matter which of the solutions I've explained you select, you're always going to have to answer to broadcasters who have paid millions to show the games that will now not go ahead. It's been highlighted by multiple people that the further down the football pyramid in this country you go, the financial effects of inactivity in no games are going to be felt hardest. Perhaps the most controversial of all would be to end the season based on current standings. For reasons I think Jake's about to go into.
Well, I was going to revisit first. Ollie, I know you looked closer at Rooney's ruling.
Yeah.
So we were saying there about how the legal challenges that would be obvious from having 22 teams or choosing Leeds and West Brom to go up ahead of the people that are close in the playoffs. Can you then just do a mini playoff? But what about the teams that are then close to the playoffs that would present legal challenges?
Yeah, so I think from 13th up to 6th, because Preston are a bit way off from Brentford and Nottingham Forest, but from them down to 13th, yeah. Anyone could realistically.
And that's the thing. So even though that's within one league, each league probably has its own little microcosm of where someone is going to be really annoyed if you just end it now or completely rule out the season and choose someone based on where they are at now. So again, I don't know how far you went into Rooney's try to get inside the brain of Wayne.
Nice.
But did you come up with any sort of potential conclusions on whether that may be the best possible fit?
I think in terms of pros and cons, I think the pros definitely outweigh the cons in terms of his argument. I think one thing that works in its favour is that it's proven to have been successful in other leagues, having a winter season. So in Sweden and Norway, they both play from March and April until November. They have done for ages and ages, and it works well. Obviously, the weather over there is pretty drastic compared to here, but it's worked well. In Russia, they did that as well until 2011, when they changed the season basically to give their teams in Europe a better opportunity of progressing in the Champions League and Europa League. In terms of the Premier League as well, it wouldn't really cause an issue to the teams playing more games in winter months. You know, pitches nowadays are pristine in all weather conditions. We've got undersoil heating at every Premier League club, and at the top level of football, it wouldn't affect things at all, really. Maybe as you filter down the leagues a little bit, it would become more of an issue. In terms of the integrity of the competition, that would pass unaffected, which will obviously mean Liverpool winning the league, the top four places being decided. Sheffield United and Wolves, who are still battling out for top four or Europa League spots, finishing as high up the league for those two clubs in particular would be a massive achievement. And also, as we touched upon as well, appeasing the broadcasters. Sky paid $3.5 billion for TV rights until the end of 2021-22 season, while BT spent $885 million. So obviously, the legal issues that can arise from games having to be cancelled or suspended would be huge. The one major con I thought of in terms of this setup would be in terms of transfers. Obviously, the Premier League the Premier League clubs voted to change the deadline back to the original one. So it's due to end in September, on September 1st. But obviously, if we had a later season, would clubs be able to trade during the season? What would happen with free agents whose contracts expire at the end of June? Same with loan players. There's a lot of clubs either fighting for top four or battling relegation. There's a lot of players sort of running out of contract or their loans are set to expire. So what happens with these guys?
There's going to have to be some kind of blanket decision from FIFA that amounts to guidance all the clubs have to follow.
I mean, that's going to be the thing, isn't it? If they decide, FIFA decide, if the decision is let's extend this, let's do the Rooney plan, then it's going to be like, okay, you have to add like 6 months onto your contract.
So yeah, just finish the
season
out.
Make it a seasonal thing rather than a pure date thing. Because otherwise, I mean, like Dean Henderson is going back to Man United. That's just the one off the top of my head. Like, and Willian is going to leave Chelsea as well, and Pedro too.
Yeah, they've got a few on the last year.
I mean, that's pretty huge. I mean, the other downside to the Rooney suggestion, which otherwise I do think is a great idea, is good luck playing summer July games in Italy and Spain full. I know you can play July again tournament games, but that's one or two games a day. This you have the whole full round of games. I mean, you have to play everything at night, basically, because the heat would be unbearable. Which, I mean, I guess...
Monday night football, Tuesday night football, Wednesday night football.
Well, it's going that way anyway.
La Liga did once have a stretch where they played like 10 days in a row. I had a game a day for 10 games in a row, so why not?
Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher are going to get extremely busy if Wayne Rooney's plan comes to fruition. So that was just one of many potential solutions to what is actually happening with the season. Before I let Ollie do his bit on some of the stuff that he found, Will mentioned that another option, and sort of the extreme option, would be to try and end the season now, but also make it an entry into the history books. So, as Will alluded to in our more serious discussion about what could happen, we're going to all exhale together and have a bit of a light-hearted discussion on what is perhaps the most controversial way of deciding what happens in the world of football. And that would be to say, the season is suspended, everything as it is now is what goes. As we touched upon, Liverpool winning the league is the least controversial of the controversial things because they have amassed such a lead at the top of the table that it would be pretty bad for them to, of all this time, after 30 years, earn a 25-point lead and then still somehow
that would
not
be
win
remarkable
the title.
If they did manage to resume the season and Liverpool went on to a league finish.
So that's the, as I said, the least controversial of the controversial. And another point to make is everything that you have just listened to, depending when you're listening to, because as we said, this is our poster boy, Squawker Talker Evergreen. You might be listening to a week after it's been recorded. A lot of things could have changed. Obviously, the UEFA meeting is the day after, so decisions could have been made. And the decision could have been to end the season. So we've addressed why that could be problematic, apart from Liverpool winning the league, because the first thing is that not everyone has played the same amount of games. Arsenal and Man City was the first game to be called off because of precautions of the coronavirus, because Man City had played a Carabao Cup final and that then was moved to Wednesday because of Champions League. That was called off, so Arsenal and Man City haven't played enough. Aston Villa, obviously the other finalists in the Carabao Cup, are fighting relegation and have not played as many games as everyone else around them. So surely it would be pretty unfair to say you're in the relegation zone, you're going down. The first obvious immediate answer, which isn't necessarily too clever or anything groundbreaking, would be to refine the table to a points per game table. Before we get into the why that could be quite silly, I'll just break down what the changes would actually be if that were the case. And there's not many changes in the Premier League. We're only treating the Premier League because it would be a bit tedious to go for every single one. The only meaningful changes would be that Sheffield United actually move up a place to sixth, meaning that they become the highest placed newly promoted team since Ipswich finished fifth in the 2001 season. And the other meaningful change, and I mean meaningful, is that Arsenal would finish above Spurs for the first time in three seasons, meaning a return of St. Tottenham's day after a three-year hiatus.
The only thing that's not been cancelled.
Yeah. So even then, Aston Villa would remain in the bottom three. This wouldn't be enough to save them, despite them claiming that we've played one less game. The interesting part is that West Ham, Watford and Bournemouth are occupying the final relegation place. They would all be on the same points. They are anyway. And that Bournemouth would go down by one goal. Minus 18, minus 17 for Watford and minus 15 for West Ham. Obviously, there's nothing to do with points per game there.
Yeah.
That's just the current standings of goal difference. So all in all, it wouldn't be a massive change to the table. So no one would have immediate claim to say, oh, we weren't there. But,
well, Spurs fans.
Yeah, but even then, that's Arsenal and Spurs. That's Arsenal, by the way, finishing in eighth instead of ninth, and Spurs finishing ninth. So both of them having miserable seasons, whatever the outcome is. But the main point about this is that obviously your points per game up to now is entirely related to who you have played. And that's where the unfairness and fairness, how do you properly calculate that? There are probably much cleverer people that would have a better way of doing it, using the likes of expected goals.
Opta probability.
Yes. Perhaps. So there are tools out there that you could use and calculate a projected points total rather than just how many points you've already got. But even then, we've seen the sort of backlash to sort of advanced statistics entering in the world of football anyway.
Sam Allardyce would not be happy.
And then as well, how do you factor in injured players coming back?
Exactly. And this
Who
is
could
the
make
thing.
A difference in individual
yeah, John
games.
McGinn's just about to come back.
Exactly.
We saw the response to the script that we did right at the beginning of the season was met with flame and fuel, which was based purely on previous seasons and projecting results. Mm. Obviously, we're not suggesting that is now used to decide the Premier League table, because Sheffield United fans would be really unhappy with that. But just the response to that means that even if they hired an elite group of five boffins to try and decide how the season actually ends based on what we've seen, people would still be unhappy with it. And to prove how silly an idea that would be, over the weekend, we tasked Oliver Trenchard, who, again, is one of those people that is probably cleverer than myself, in finding out some ways to decide the title based on current standings, but with other hypotheticals in the way. The first of which was, what if every shot that hit the woodwork actually went in?
It's got to be Man City. Probably won't.
Liverpool still win the league by 13 points, which surprised me as well.
Yeah.
The interesting bit from this is that Norwich get 6 points extra and climb up to 16th in the table. Aston Villa, no points differential, but they finish bottom.
Uh-huh.
So they're the only teams that... Norwich's leap is so grand that Aston Villa end up being bottom of the table. You have the top four that remains the same: Liverpool, Man City, Leicester, Chelsea. Man United get fifth, Spurs sixth, Arsenal seventh. So St. Tottering's Dame absence extends. And Sheffield United and Wolves drop down to eighth and ninth, where if we did points per game, they'd be getting a European place.
That's typical of Norwich this season, given their injury problems. And lucky in multiple ways.
Just unlucky in general. And it also aligns itself with the teams with the most money then just find their way. If you give people reward for luck or whatever, the top seven.
You'd think that the teams with the least money would get the least more karma than the other ones.
Yeah, but no. There's crippling agendas against...
No, life doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
There's crippling agendas against anyone with not enough money. Other ones included, and again, I didn't put any of these together, but I'm sharing the information with you now. Premier League table excluding goals from English players.
Wow.
The Arsene Wenger table.
Sheffield United relegated.
I guess if it's just English players, they might have a view.
At least Musset would do it.
So Liverpool finished top again, which again just highlights that, again, if they somehow don't win the league, there's no way you can spin it that they're not top of the table. Manchester City remains second. Who do you think is third?
It's not going to be Leicester, is it? It'll be...
I think it would be Leicester.
No.
Will, do you have any guesses?
No. Okay. Maybe Wolves?
Yes. The Portuguese revolution would lead them into a Champions League spot.
I'm Mexican.
Okay.
Big route.
But I'm just saying they famously got about nine Portugal players in their team. Arsenal would then be fourth. Manchester United, again, remain fifth.
Really? That's interesting, given like...
Rashford's maybe not as important as you thought he was.
Hot take.
But it's based on the game. So this is all calculated by, obviously, each individual game as well. So Rashford's goals may have... Other people would have scored in that game, potentially, and they would have been close by...
Not the Big Six games.
I know, but they won't have as many points. That's other teams are then losing it. So what I'm saying is, though Big Six ones maybe become less relevant.
Yeah.
Again, we maybe do further investigations into what these actually mean, given there's no football. So I'm just giving you the baseline numbers first. Relegation, Aston Villa, Norwich and Southampton finished bottom of this table.
Danny Ings.
And also, obviously, if anyone doubles checks these and they just turn out to be wrong in any way, blame Ollie. And not the Ollie on the podcast. The Ollie that is not here to defend himself. Oh, yeah, sorry. Sheffield United finished ninth.
Okay.
So not as bad.
Not too far away then.
Another one. Premier League table without goals from each team's top scorer is potentially interesting. Liverpool top.
Again top, yeah.
Yeah. Share the goals.
Manchester City second. Leicester third. Yeah. A new person in fourth. New team in fourth.
Chelsea?
Nope.
No. New team.
Oh, Chelsea are fourth, aren't they?
I mean, Sheffield United's top goal scorer is Lee. Is it still Lee Smith? Yeah. So and I imagine that, Sheffield United. Yeah, Sheffield United.
And Will's got it correct again. Oh. Someone's hacked the access to these files. Tottenham fifth, Man United sixth. Arsenal, which obviously is the classic Aubameyang. Where would they be without him? They'd be 10th. above Wolves, which is somewhere... if you said,
probably take that, wouldn't
you? If you said, would you like to finish above Wolves? Many Arsenal fans would say yes. Little do they know, it means that they would be a mid-table team with a goal difference of 0.
Oof, that's brutal. That is brutal.
This is another favourite, I think, or it should go down quite well, was a Premier League table if penalties didn't count.
Yes.
Oof. Yeah.
Because
Man United bottom three.
Because what are penalties? I'm trying to find hone in on the name. I've got where Man United finished. So again, Liverpool win the league. We know that. Man City. In fact, the top four are the same. Okay. Arsenal become fifth. Burnley in sixth. Sheffield United seventh. Tottenham eighth. And Manchester United drop down to ninth in this. Wolves
That's honestly
again.
Higher than I thought they would be.
Yeah. So did I. You're Bruno's relegated.
Bumped them up.
Yeah, I suppose.
After his one the other week.
Yeah, your relegated trio is Aston Villa, Bournemouth and Norwich. Oh,
poor Norwich. Can't catch a break.
This one is...
Sitting in the cup.
Well, yeah, we don't talk about it.
I'm not sure why this one was... This would be completely bizarre. And by the way, I know this is silly and it would never, ever be used.
I think if anyone's not taking all of these with a pinch of salt by now...
But you need your recommended daily amounts times 10 of salt with this one, because... If every shot on target went in. So basically, if every team had Claudio Bravo.
So the Kepa Arrieta Balaga table then.
Insert your least favourite goalkeeper joke here. So again, this is interesting in terms of it. Each game shot on target. So this doesn't mean the team with the most shots on target in the league will win. Because it's about, obviously, each specific game. I hope that's how Ollie's done it again.
And how many shots on target you record in a game versus how many shots on target you concede.
Exactly. Liverpool win the league.
Of course.
Chelsea finished second under Lampard. Yeah. Incredible effort. Man City dropped to third. Manchester United finished fourth. Ollie's at the wheel. Keep him in the job. Interesting one. Southampton leap all the way to seventh.
Wow.
Which is... which has got two genuine wows, I think. The bottom three will skip
that
right down.
That does make sense, though, because Southampton are just renowned for being wasteful until Danny Ings started banging goals in. So that makes sense.
So, yeah, it's sort of one for the purists that believe Southampton have been quite good. They just need to face no goalies.
The what bottom would the 9-0 three result have been if shots on target count?
No, I don't know. I haven't got this. I can go down, but it would require a lot of reading. The bottom three is interesting because 18th is Crystal Palace, 19th is Arsenal.
Bernd Leno is.
Oh yeah, because he's been absolutely bombarded.
He's been having a man
the second most saves. I think.
And Arsenal don't have any shots, let alone get them on target.
And Newcastle at the bottom, right?
No, Watford.
Watford, oh, okay.
Newcastle are at 17th.
Yeah, so...
So basically, definitely don't use this one because it's completely unfair.
The 9-0 game would have finished 15-3, incidentally.
15-3.
So even
worse. 9-0 is a ridiculous scoreline anyway. Yeah.
So you may as well make it 15-3. And the last one, again, because Ollie Trenchard, as a Watford fan, also did... The PL table with only goals from Senegalese under-25 players counted, which, of course, Watford would win. But the one of actual note is if games lasted 80 minutes, Liverpool win the league, Man City second, Chelsea third, Leicester fourth, Man United fifth, Arsenal sixth. So a boring top six. Sheffield United seventh, Wolves eighth. So it's all of the sort of big names. And the bottom three becomes Bournemouth, Newcastle United and Norwich City. So Aston Villa, that seems like one of the few... that they would escape relegation with. So
Newcastle late stage merchants, aren't they?
So Premier League.
I can only imagine how much of a headache those league tables are to do. So well done, Ollie.
Yeah, exactly. That was his...
Not Ollie. He's on the podcast now, after all.
Ollie's French table.
Yeah, so thank you for all of those. And Premier League, if you want to use any of them, then as long as you tag us in the tweet, you can do just that. We'll be right back. So now we've decided how the Premier League table should or shouldn't be won, we're going to talk about another side effect of the indefinite suspension, potentially, of all football. Ollie briefly mentioned contracts and loan players. Will they or will they won't be available after the ban is, or after the suspension ends? But another one that I thought was quite interesting is injured players that now have an indefinite period of time to recover, especially the ones that have been out for a long time or ruled out for the season. They now have time to recover. It may be difficult. Will, you mentioned the sort of personal plans that players have been sent to try and build fitness. As an injured player, if they have access, again, we're talking about the elite level players, they'll have the ability to get access to equipment that will help them recover. But one in particular that was close to coming back, the first name, I've got a few names here that I thought were interesting, and then we'll discuss some main candidates in greater depth. But Leroy Sané was on the verge of returning. He now has an even longer break. But what I found interesting about him is that will he or won't he become a transfer target for a team now? Because not only is he being injured for 9 months, he won't have played a football match probably for a year if worst case scenarios are to be expected. So does he now need another season without spending 80 million on him, or does he just come back seamlessly into the Man City side and Bayern just pick him up, whatever standard is?
I think Bayern would probably take the risk on him anyway, because it's just, you can eat with the attacking options they have, they could ease him back in.
It seemed like they were trying to sign him in the middle of his injury.
Yeah.
I think it's just a question of, because they're going to try and get the price down on the basis of his lack of football.
Well, also his contract, I think, expires in 2021.
So that would all bring his price down. So as well. Bayern, from a purely cynical point of view,
quids in,
are enjoying the fact that he's not had a chance to prove his worth again, playing football for Man City, and all of the factors.
He wasn't even playing well when he got injured. That's the other thing as well.
It was literally at the start of the season.
Yeah.
So there was no. I don't think you can judge anyone's form. Wasn't it the Community Shield that he got injured in?
I think so.
So he played a bad 80 minutes. So he should be worth nothing. Completely flipping the coin on a signing that has happened and now looks to be awful is Cedric Suarez for Arsenal. He was initially signed on loan. I believe there was an option to buy, but that's going to be really interesting what happens there, because he literally hasn't played a single minute.
Expires as well at Southampton, doesn't it?
So whether Arsenal just get him on the free transfer because his contract's
and
expired.
Arsenal paid $4 million for the privilege.
So they've paid $4 million to get first dibs on a utility 30-year-old right back. So that's just another side of the coin. Someone that I'm really excited about finally seeing again. It seems like it's been two years since. Well, do you know who I'm going to say? Go on then.
Ruben off the street.
No.
Oh, wow. can't believe I was wrong.
Is David Brooks.
I bet you are excited about that one there.
No. But he's been mooted to come back so soon as well. Mm. I don't even have him on my list because I've already thought about that and got excited about it.
Great, doesn't he?
So I thought David Brooks at Bournemouth, who has been out for
the whole season.
Bournemouth themselves have experienced a lot of ACL serious knee injuries, so there's been sort of questions asked of what's happening exactly there in terms
They've
of training
really
methods and
well.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So he's someone that could come back, or again might need the extra time to recover, to get fully fit, build the strength back in a knee, and then could turn back and be like, remember me. There are players like John McGinn, I think we mentioned, for Aston Villa's sort of battle
pretty
for relegation.
Well, has returned to like contact training, I'm pretty sure.
So he was close. Players like Nicolò Zaniolo recently suffered an ACL injury. So again, these are based on worst cases.
Memphis as well. Was set to miss the Euros.
Jumped in. No, it's absolutely
off the tip
fine.
Of your tongue.
No, it's fine, because that's what, if anyone else has thought about it, but he was the one that I was going to dive a bit deeper into, because before he was injured, and if you look at the stats of Netherlands under Ronald Koeman, Memphis Depay is pretty much involved in every single goal they've scored, whether he scores it himself or assists Jeannie Wijnaldum, it seems. So for them, in terms of their chances of winning an international tournament, should it be pushed back to 2021, they should have their talisman back fully fit, because
No, that's it. They were genuine contenders with Van Dijk, with De Ligt, with De Jong. They were genuine contenders to win one out and playing so well.
UEFA Nations League finalists.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And
no
they,
less.
They were unlucky there. And they genuinely worked contenders for Europe. But without Memphis, it all falls apart. Because like you said, they don't have a number nine. He's their false nine. He's the key to the whole attack working. Without him, it doesn't exist. And yeah, that, I mean, Koeman must be, I mean, not, obviously no one's happy about this, but he stands to gain, in terms of all international managers, I think he stands to gain the most. Well, maybe,
you'd also imagine an extra year of club football for De Jong and De Ligt would also be massive for them as well, because they've both had sort of teething problems at their clubs since leaving Ajax.
Louis van Gaal feeling that they should have swapped clubs.
Yeah.
We need a freaky Frankie Friday. Not sure De Ligt.
Also, speaking, Roberto Martinez might be happy because Eden Hazard is, he's out for the rest of the season at Real Madrid. Or, well, he was going to be.
Yeah.
You'd imagine if it restarts, he'll be back. And I mean, and he's a huge shot in the eye. He'd be a huge shot in the eye for Madrid. And Marco Asensio, who's also basically missed the whole season.
So Marco Asensio was another name I had here because, again, the man that scored in every debut he had for Real Madrid came on against Arsenal in a preseason game. Turned the game around completely, got a knee injury, haven't seen him in a competitive game since.
Yeah.
And I've not really even heard much about how that recovery's going. So that seemed really serious. But again, he's now got the time to completely refocus and recover to full strength and then maybe be involved in a post-season, pre-season warm-up.
Luis
essentially.
Suarez as well for Barcelona. He's ruled out.
But he
season.
Should be sold on anyway. So
well, probably should, but there's also Ousmane Dembele.
He's a cooked chicken, I think was the terminology we used on a podcast a while ago.
Sounds like something I'd say. But no, but also Ousmane Dembele, although they technically had to deregister Dembele to register Barton Brathwaite. So he couldn't. If they did bring it back, they'd have to sort something out there.
Which again could lead into some bizarre transfer lower fee if they've given up on Ousmane Dembele because of his injury problems and they've got that slot taken and the season continues, then it could mean cut price availability of a really talented young player, and Youssef Attal was the other name that I had down that I think was emerging as one of the most exciting sort of wing backs in Ligue 1 and unfortunately suffered an injury. So
well,
again,
talking about the Euro team, sort of works well for Gareth Southgate as well. If you look at England's attack, it's been decimated the last couple of months. Harry Kane and Rashford would have gone into it undercooked, having not played for 2-3 months, if not longer. Tammy Abraham was probably Kane's first backup based on his exploits in the first half of the season. He's been injured as well, so from that perspective, it's probably helped out England's preparations.
No need to get Jamie Vardy out of retirement, which was the mooted solution to that. But then the flip side of that is players like Danny Ings, who were potentially on the way to their first call-up.
It'd be a shame if he doesn't get a cap now, a second cap.
So it works both ways. In the ideal sense,
sure he did his ACL just after his first England cap. Mm. So
he's done both knees.
Yeah. So one of the most unfortunate players with regards to England careers.
Perpetually unlucky, Danny Ings. Then. So they were the main names that I had down. If anyone else had sort of someone tucked away that now I've said it,
I think Tom Heaton coming back for Villa, and I mean, this goes back to what we were saying right at the start of the podcast. I mean, we don't know when the league is going to resume.
Yeah,
it might be ages, but he obviously did his ACL in January, so that return is going to be something around 9 months probably. But if you look at Reina's mistake in the most recent outing, then goalkeeper position's an issue, and it's one that Tom Heaton, who worked wonders for Burnley when they were in their more relegation threatened phases. One of those goalkeepers who really just thrives when
he's getting absolutely peppered.
having him there at Villa, I think, is a bit of a game changer.
And it was also Wesley as well when they got a double whammy, didn't they?
So I think his is a little bit worse. I think they were saying 12 months for Wesley when he did his.
But the extent to which, even if it means that this recovery is being done without games being lost, is the sort of point I was trying to make as well, is there's recovery for recovery's sake rather than trying to rush back to get to fixtures. So it might be a really good resting point for those injured players. But the one person that I sort of said at the beginning of the podcast that we would discuss in terms of genuine football analysis rather than just discussing what could happen and what couldn't happen based on silly hypotheticals we thought that you might enjoy a bit of discussion about how Manchester United try and fit February Premier League Player of the Month, Bruno Fernandes, and World Cup winner, Paul Pogba, in the same team. Because if we're talking about players that have been injured for a long time and we've been waiting for their return, Paul Pogba has definitely been one of those.
He's basically been out since the end of August. He played two 90 minutes back-to-back in the start of September, but then that's been... He had a kind of little cameo in on Boxing Day and the day after, and that's been there.
So he's very much...
shooting hoops, though, in the meantime.
You better stay fit.
Well, yeah, which is absolutely fine, as long as he's not injuring himself. As long as he's not breaking any self-isolation orders, Mason. But that is the big question that's being asked recently, because Ole Gunnar Solskjaer recently came out and said, I imagine him to be here. That was before football was suspended. Yeah. So it wasn't, I imagine him to be here when it resumes. It was for the next season, based on his contract. It was that he expected Paul Pogba to be in that team. Bruno Fernandes has come in. He has not lost a Premier League game yet. Man United haven't lost a game since he signed. As I said, Premier League Player of the Month, won it in his first month of football in the competition. The third Portuguese winner after Ronaldo and Deco.
Respect for Nani.
All signs pointing towards that he is the man that will lead their recharge, not a lead of recharge, just lead their charge into a Champions League spot and become potential title contenders.
Yeah, and the midfield is, for a club like Manchester United, so much of his history is caught up in that particular position, having that great midfield. Think of the players like Paul Scholes, Roy Keane, all these ones that basically set the template against which all future Manchester United midfielders are going to be compared. You put Pogba and Fernandes in the midfield together, it raises a couple of questions. Firstly, are those two enough to give United potentially the best midfield in the Premier League on paper? Manchester City would obviously have Manchester City fans would have a thing or two to say about that, but
just on Kevin De Bruyne alone.
Yeah, exactly. Throughout all the big clubs, we're seeing with Liverpool a shift away from making the midfield as important in an attacking sense. But then the flip side is Pogba was already considered a midfielder around which it's proven elusive as to how you build a midfield that works for several Manchester United, well, just two Manchester United managers, those being Mourinho and Solskjaer. If you put Fernandes into the equation, another player, he would say, oh, you've got to build United's midfield around him. Then you get a position where the most important role in midfield actually becomes the other person in that midfield, because they're the ones who have to balance everything out to make it work. So it's a question. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is my point. It's I love the idea of putting Fernandes and Pogba in the same midfield. Is at first you think, what? Because they do actually operate in the same role, where Pogba was the... it's supposed to be the attacking number 10. Bruno Fernandes is the attacking number 10. Bruno Fernandes has settled in and done brilliantly. But you could play both of them together. But the thing is, what you couldn't do is right now, like Jason, is that the best midfield if you have those two in midfield with a third guy? And I would say, given who United's third guys would be, it's not. Because Fred's very good. He's really come on well, but he's played well. He's always played with a holder, whether it's Taras Stepanenko, whether it's Casemiro, whether it's for Brazil, or whether it's Scott McTominay or Nemanja Matic. He's always played with a genuine holder next to him, and he does well there. He does well in that role, in a double pivot. You couldn't put him as the main holder. It's not what he does best. He's too one-footed, for one thing. Nemanja Matic, I've been over his limitations before. He's actually playing well under Solskjaer, but again, in a double pivot. You couldn't put him as a single guy. So that leaves you with Scott McTominay. And I like Scott McTominay a lot, but he's not on that level. Like Will says, the most important, for two players like Pogba and Fernandes, who are so attacking and attack minded, you need someone who is not just able to run around and make tackles, which McTominay can do all day, but has the intelligence and awareness to mark space brilliantly. And I don't know if McTominay is that kind of player. If they signed a defensive midfielder, like they've linked with Dennis Zakaria, I think, if they signed a genuine holder, someone who has the intelligence to play that role the way that Michael Carrick used to play it, the way that Sergio Busquets plays it, the way that even N'Golo Kante plays it, although he plays it differently, but with the same sort of coverage, then okay, yeah, you could say that could be one hell of a midfield, because you look at Fernandes can play 8, can play 10, you look at Pogba can play 8, can play 10, they can both run with the ball, Pogba especially so, Pogba in open field is basically unstoppable, you can see the two of them linking well with, Pogba plays an outlet pass to Fernandes dinks it back to Pogba into space and Pogba's just gone, you can't catch him.
Dreaming about it.
Yes. They can both score goals. They both got great long-range shots. That's the key thing, I think, as well. Part of the problem United have of breaking down defensive sides is no one wants to close out on their shooters because no one thinks, oh, Fred's not going to score from there. No one closes out. So then you have to pick the pass. And then you know, also don't really have anyone that can really pick that final pass. Bruno Fernandes can do both. He can shoot and he can pass, but he's only one guy. So you put two guys on him, suddenly, I mean, no one's doing that yet, but they will eventually figure out, oh, if we just put two guys on Fernandes, United are rubbish. They're useless. So if you have to close out Fernandes and Pogba, both as shooters and passers, then it becomes like Golden State Warriors. It's just impossible to guard them. That there's too many shooters who can also pass the ball. It's like, how do you step up? Do you sit back? If you're doing it, you're letting one of them either shoot from range or get a pass off. And then you add in the fact that, as you said, Rashford could be back from injury. Rashford coming off the left. Martial up front. Dan James is a good runner. On the right, not a great player necessarily, but a good runner. And you've got options that are deadly. But so offensively, I think it would be fantastic to watch. I think United would absolutely start smashing the weaker sides. But defensively, I think you would lose, unless they were prepared to rest one of them for big games, which I don't see Solskjaer doing, given his the way he approaches managing United, you know, in the image of Sir Alex Ferguson, almost to a comical degree. He would never rest his two best players in big games.
Like, wasn't Ferguson? Hasn't he been applauded for being able playing teams that beat big teams despite not having all his stars?
Like Park Ji-sung was.
Yeah. So
yeah, but
in the big games,
John O'Shea, people like that.
One of them comes in and replaces it because they know that that's the best chance to win that game.
But Ferguson, that's the thing. Ferguson, that was Ferguson. Solskjaer is Ferguson light. I don't know. I mean, look.
If he's trying to imitate that thing, then maybe he needs an opportunity to say, like, look how strong I am. Yeah. I can leave out a big player.
That's true.
In the big game, because as we discussed on last week's podcast and the videos that we've created, they've nailed how to play against the big teams, and it's working for them.
The only way they could play both against the big teams would be to play Bruno Fernandes as one of the forwards, basically. You have Pogba playing essentially the role he played for Juventus, where he was in the midfield three and he rampaged forward, and then you play the passes off Bruno Fernandes. But again, then you're not really using Bruno Fernandes to the best of his ability.
Well, and you're not using your two forwards to split the whole team.
So it changes. It would be functional, but it wouldn't be as devastating effective as it is right now.
So we've obviously gone straight in there and spoke about how Man United could line up with Paul Pogba, when the sort of the counter school of thought is that he doesn't need to be in the team at all anyway, because Fred's performing really well, Matic is probably performing really well, McTominay is back, etc. Those players, for the most part, were all available last season. And Pogba ranked first in Man United's squad for goals, assists, shots on target, take-ons completed, fouls won, chances created, possession won, passes into the final third, and duels won. So, despite many people believing that he isn't a good player or he struggles in certain games or cannot be relied upon enough, I think the one objective truth is that he is good.
Oh, he's
Pogba has won a World Cup. And this was the thing that I wanted to focus on, is because you could argue that Man United can learn from France and their World Cup winning team in order to get the best out of Paul Pogba, because they have a lot of players that can fit into the specific roles. I say specific roles because I'm going to name drop players, but a lot of the criticism that has been used against Deschamps is that it's very much a team of very good players set out to be quite conservative and then punish teams that are good against them, and therefore they have struggled against the smaller teams, which is what Man United happen to do as well. So maybe this isn't the solution. Maybe it will just is another way to create the same problems. But I thought I'd just run through a few of the roles in that France team and the Man United players that are the leading candidates to sort of fill that job spec in order to get the best out of Paul Pogba, which is what everyone wants. And I think is what fans of watching football would want to see. Initially, the most important thing in the midfield is that you need that ball winner. N'Golo Kanté for France played, and we'll discuss. I'll go into the specifics of it a bit more. Was essentially the deepest midfielder of all of France's midfielders. He made at least 12 more interceptions than any other France player at the World Cup. Only Lucas Hernandez, the left-back, made more tackles. And interestingly, he also completed the most passes for France. So that, again, is the way that they were playing, in the sense that they weren't expansive, dominating possession in every game they played at the World Cup. Nope. N'Golo Kanté was the hub of that team, received more of the ball and therefore completed the most passes. Most of them, I imagine, were to his right, which is where Paul Pogba was waiting. And Pogba's role in that France side was different to what we're usually told is his best role, or where he must play for Man United. Mm. You mentioned there at the top of that him and Fernandes are the creators of the number 10s. Mm. I would contest that and disagree that Paul Pogba can do that, for sure. But I think he can be used in a slightly different role that would then complement Bruno Fernandes. And I've put him down as the sort of quarterback in that France team, in the sense that he was deeper and more reserved and aiming to launch their counterattacks.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I remember when I was analysing the World Cup. One of the things I said was that Deschamps basically had recreated the France 98 system, but he put, because there was no Zidane, he basically split the Zidane role in the attacking part, the goal scoring part, was handled by Kylian Mbappe, making runs in behind. And the playmaking aspect fell to Pogba, who became like a sort of hyped-up Christian Carambo in that system. So he helped out defensively, worked defensively in midfield. But instead of just moving forward and linking play, he actually was just the chief architect, along with Griezmann. So it's like Zidane and Djorkaeff, but him and Griezmann.
So, yeah, so this is what I'm going to discuss more, is Pogba's chance creation numbers in that World Cup were very low, but he ranked quite high for tackles within the team. He won the most duels, which, again, if we're going to discuss the differences between Fernandes and Pogba and the strengths of them, Pogba is an athletic player. Fernandes, we spoke about, is tenacious and gets around the pitch. But Pogba, again, in the World Cup, was leading aerial duels 1 per 90 for France, duels 1 per 90 in general. And we spoke about his ability to take on players, win fouls. Paul Pogba, the deeper he gets and the more chances he gets to turn an opponent and drive, as you mentioned, Mo, the better. So I actually quite like him in a slightly reserved role. And the main sort of part of this job spec that I highlighted was the ability to switch the tempo of the game with one swish of his football boot, which we know Pogba can do.
Yeah.
We've seen his passes during the 4-0 win against Chelsea at the beginning of the season, two gloriously executed passes that led to two counter-attacking goals for Man United. Yeah, that's what I mean. So that combination, I feel like this role, slightly reserved, suits him perfectly. And then that becomes, where does Fernandes play? We've already occupied two midfield spots.
Just on that Pogba thing. The fact that you mention his athleticism as well, you could have him in that sort of reserved role, but then as the game wears on, you could maybe just push him on a little bit more. Like in the World Cup final, Kante was the destroyer next to him, but he came off after 55 minutes and Zonzi came on and just shielded, and 4 minutes later Pogba went up the other end and scored. So you can sort of let him off the leash a little bit, depending on where the game is, because he can just run and run for ages.
And who you decide to play in that. So I said ball winner, but the deepest of the three, the number six, if you will, depending on who you're playing or what you want to do, this is where you start to have options and you discover the best one. You've mentioned perhaps the inability of Fred to execute this role. I think, based on what I was looking at, what Conte did for France at the World Cup, I think he could do okay in it. You could try Matic there to see. I'm not saying these are the solutions, but based on what Man United have now, the candidates for that role would be Fred, McTominay and Matic. One of those three would fill that role. Then you have Pogba in the Pogba role, of course. Yeah. And then this leaves Bruno Fernandes. And I actually think there are extreme similarities between how Griezmann was used for France in the World Cup and how Bruno Fernandes should or is being used currently anyway, because the first of which is that Griezmann took every single set piece in that team. He was on there as the chief technical expert to organise all of those set piece deliveries. One, because he's not that tall himself, so it works. Paul Pogba, as I mentioned, has the ability to win headers, although he would probably be a good set piece taker in himself. So Bruno Fernandes already gets to do what he's doing now. Take every single set piece, organise all of that. The moments of magic that we saw for one of the goals against Man City. The quick thought when everyone else is stationary. Griezmann in the World Cup was the leading creator for the side, and that's already what we want to see from Fernandes there. And he was also the leading shot taker. So this role, which I've put as like a modern number 10, in not the sense that it was every chance created was him, it's the ability to create chances, but also just make chances for yourself. We've already seen that with Fernandes. His chance creation numbers are actually lower than his shot production numbers, But the perfect manager of those two is exactly what you need in this role. And a defensive shift is required anyway in this role. Griezmann, again, had 10 tackles in the World Cup, which was within the top six of France. The midfielders and Griezmann were the leaders in that, as well as one of the fullbacks. And Bruno Fernandes does that as well. So I think he can...
He's also good-looking, but not the best-looking guy on the team, just like Griezmann.
The most important part of it.
Yes, absolutely,
I guess.
Of course.
You always throw me with those completely ridiculous things. Yes, so basically, I feel like Bruno Fernandes could execute that role pretty much perfectly. Quickly, again, not to sort of dive too far into it, and mention how France and Man United actually have similar personnel. Their fullbacks were centre-backs at the World Cup.
Yeah.
Benjamin Pavard is making the transition, at least even if it's in a back three, into his preferred role at centre-back, which is where he played for Stuttgart. Lucas Hernandez, we know, can play left-back and was effective, especially there was one goal, of course, where Lucas Hernandez crossed it. It fell to Pavard, and he scored. But their crossing numbers, they had 20 crosses between them in the World Cup, 10 each. Chances created, Pavard 2. They weren't necessarily the modern fullback, as we say, with Liverpool all of the time. They weren't there to provide the cutbacks themselves.
They weren't Alves and Marcelo.
Yeah, they were there primarily because they were very good defenders, or better defenders than you may. Benjamin Mendy was in the squad, we know, wasn't used at all. Man United have that. Wan-Bissaka is improving in the attacking phase, of course, but he excels at not letting other teams score rather than helping his own team score. He sits in perfectly. And at left back, we don't quite know what Luke Shaw's future holds. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer recently said he's the best fullback, left back England have when he's fully firing. Contest that all you will, but with Luke Shaw and Brandon Williams there, again, when you play a right footer on the left back, their main priority is going to be
defending.
Be quite defensive. They won't have the natural ability to stretch play. So Man United, again, have a similar setup in terms of how their back four would operate, leaving their attacking players, as I've said, Pogba, Fernandes, to do what they want. The final example and sort of role that would need to be filled is obviously where do the goals come from? Olivier Giroud had 13 shots at the World Cup. None were on target and therefore none went in. But they won the World Cup.
Yes.
Their goals came from Griezmann's set pieces and Kylian Mbappe. And Kylian Mbappe and Marcus Rashford need no introduction into the sort of perceived rivalry or comparisons that are always drawn between them. Both absolutely rapid.
Mm-hmm.
Both brilliant goal scorers beyond their years. Mm. And Mbappe at the World Cup completed 34 take-ons, which I think was the most, if not the second most, at the World Cup. And the next France player in that team was 8. Rashford usually fulfills the same role for Man United, so I feel like they tick all the boxes.
Another comparison I've just realised you're making. I think McTominay could do well. Fred and Matuidi, quite similar in the way that they can play. They're both left-footed, both got an underrated ability to move the ball around themselves and be in the right position to help defensively and offensively to break forward. Fred loves running forward. If you look at him, he loves a gallop forward and you know, not necessarily to shoot, but to cross, to pass. So, you know, you could put Fred in the Matuidi role, put McTominay deep.
So that is the final position that I haven't mentioned. We have two of the three, or at France at the World Cup, I think they played closer to a 4-3-3 than what was always presented in graphic form as a 4-2-3-1 with Matuidi left wing.
Mm.
I felt like he became more of a central midfielder, a shuttler, if you will. Griezmann moved out towards that left role, but was very free. Mm. Olivier Giroud up front, and then Mbappe, as I said, was a wide forward, but a winger. So you swap Rashford and Mbappe round in terms of position.
Mm.
Rashford becomes your wide forward on the left side. And then you find someone to shuttle from that right-hand side, which could be a Fred. It could be a more attacking option in terms of Daniel James. Build him in that role to an extent. That would be the one thing they need to fix, but I feel like they have a lot of similarities with how Deschamps maximised the abilities of Pogba whilst also not sacrificing the team's effectiveness completely, which is often, again, I think, is the debate, isn't it? Is all of building around Pogba, but then you build around him so much that you become worse because of it.
Yeah. I think the main thing Pogba never had or couldn't get together with his time at United so far is that he never had a midfield partner that was his equal. Whether that's because Mourinho destroyed their confidence at a certain Armenian players, or whether it's just that they just weren't as good as him. And with Bruno Fernandes, there's a player, Paul, but you know, you have to do it all yourself, Paul. Here's a guy who's as good as you, same level as you, or similar level as you anyway. Work with him, make something happen. And you know, that's the thing. And the thing is, even if, I mean, and you can tell United want to actually, we're talking about like our hypotheticals about how United might play them together. It's clear that United want to pair Fernandes with a player, if not Pogba, then someone like Pogba, because they've been linked with Jack Grealish. So the idea is, if Paul Pogba does go, which, I mean, we don't know. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. What happens with the season? We have no idea. But if he does go, then clearly the idea would be, let's get in Jack Grealish.
I think they're completely different players.
No, I would agree. But you clear that they want to pair the two of them together. I don't know. Or rather, they want to pair Fernandes with another elite midfield creator. I don't know.
Jack Grealish, three of them? Jack Grealish could come in and play where we mentioned, because Matuidi was very central.
Yeah.
There was less ball carrying, which is what we've always said about Jack Grealish being the most. But yeah. There's a potential for him to. That's a left wing role by. It's not complete midfield role.
Yeah.
So there are potentials for still new signings to fill those gaps that I mentioned. But I just thought about it in terms of what's the best Pogba we've seen in the last two or three years. You would say it was potentially at the World Cup. Yeah. In which he wasn't necessarily leading every metric for France, but became the team player that every Man United fan wants him to be, whilst also showing glimpses of that obscene footballing quality that we know he has.
It's interesting that we're advising Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to mimic Didier Deschamps, considering the pillaring he got for his tactics at the World Cup. And just like even mentioning Matuidi, I remember in the first game they started Ousmane Dembele on the left wing and played a 4-3-3. Giroud didn't start either. And then they laboured to a 2-1 win against Australia. Second game he brought Matuidi in, and in that sort of hybrid role that you mentioned. And suddenly it just frees up everyone. And Giroud as well is just an unselfish striker, as we mentioned, didn't score or get a shot on target. But he's one of those players that's renowned for bringing out the best in other players as well. So... yeah, I mean, he actually, in hindsight, got it spot on.
I tried to say at the beginning that I still feel that France won a lot of those games because by design, the better...
individual quality.
But as well, and the better the team they played, the better they played, and the more that their strengths countered the weaknesses of opponents. Yeah. Whereas when they play Denmark, in a lot of the Euro 2020 qualifiers that they played, they laboured two poor results.
Yeah.
So... my solution in getting the best out of Bruno Fernandes and Paul Pogba is perhaps creating the exact same problems Man United have now, in that they will still beat every single big team they play against, but when they play against a perceived weaker opposition, you get unstuck by not being able to break them down.
But the thing is, by having him and Fernandes, you've got an extra star in that side that can produce something out of nothing.
I mean,
whereas Fernandes is pretty much doing it on his own now, especially with Rashford out as well.
Yeah, not to get too much into the France game, but that Australia game was the worst game to play Dembele, to not play Giroud, because that's the kind of game Australia just sat in, and that's the kind of game where you want Giroud to break them down, to hold the ball up, be a target man. The other games is where he could have let them play, and then that was France's criticism. We all criticised Deschamps, I know I did, because not that they didn't, he made the right choices, I think, with his lineup, starting lineups a lot. But then what happened was, in the second half of the games, he could have made just a tiny attacking change and absolutely won every game out of canter, because France they took the lead, like you said, by design. They took the lead, they scored, and then they held their lead, and then they were defensive. But then their defence was just, it was just hoof it to Mbappe. If they brought on another fast player, Dembele, Fekir, whoever it was, they could have absolutely killed teams.
Basically, your answer to every manager's issues is
Ousmane Dembele.
Why didn't he bring Ousmane Dembele on early?
Pretty much, yeah. No, but look, United have a manager like Solskjaer who would take a bit more risk and would maybe let them off the leash to attack and hit them on the break with a bit more gusto. So I don't think he would face the same criticisms as Deschamps if he adopted, as Jake says, Deschamps' system.
So we felt like that Paul Pogba Bruno Fernandes debate did need a bit of a break, but you're not coming back to much, because that is all we've got time for this week. I hope that we've dived into enough that will keep you busy during this period of uncertainty. And the most important thing as well is to say subscribe to the school. No, it's not that at all. It's, of course, to make sure that everyone is keeping safe. Follow the guidelines that, as we've mentioned plenty of times, we'll be constantly updating. Keep yourself informed with that, and keep aligned with the best practice to make sure that hopefully football will return as soon as possible. And that means the Squawker Talker will return as soon as possible.